the long history of recapping a previous episode is not uncommon to the history of the movies or TV. But 24 years ago, there was one show that took it to an art form. That was the show 24. To those of you who watched TV before there was Netflix and Crave and on-demand cable streaming, you know the feeling of waiting for a show to broadcast with clues of what would happen to Jack Bauer last week, which would give you a sense of what was going to happen to him this week. So with last week being part one of a two-part sermon franchise, this is the last one. This was previously heard last week. With Israel facing a war on its southwestern border and at the same time being threatened on its north and eastern borders by Hezbollah and Iran, and also at the same time facing international pressures and criticisms that no other country faces. I mean that literally. If Martians landed on the world tomorrow and read the news, they would conclude that the one persistent obstacle to world peace is Israel and the Jews. And if that wasn't enough, Israel is now facing an eternal crisis which warns to fracture the country. The crisis became effective because Israel's Supreme Court ordered on April the 1st a complete halt to all monies being paid to the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox rabbinical seminaries, which house men over the age of 18. And why would they order that? Because Israel has a mandatory draft which calls all of its Jewish citizens over the age of 18 for either military service or a national Peace Corps-like service. A third option there is not. But since the founding of the state, there has been an ad hoc understanding that exempt full-time rabbinical scholars from military service. But when this agreement was hatched, there were less than 400 of those men in that category. As of this year, the number exceeds 66,000. As the money now is drying run on those seminaries, the students, many of whom are married and with children, will have difficult choices to make. Without their stipends, they will need to find work. Teachers without salaries will need to do the same. Schools may need to be mothballed because they won't have funds to pay for electricity, water, food, and insurance. For nearly 20 years, the Haredim have been nearly 20% of Israel's population. But for nearly 75 years, they have opposed integration, self-reliance, and secular education. When they were but 4% of the population, it was easy to ignore. But this is difficult to accept any longer. The Haredim are the inheritors of a stream of fundamentalist Judaism that has its roots in the 1800s. As mass changes were taking over the Western world, emancipation, rationalism, science, the Industrial Revolution, and Zionism, Judaism cleaved into different pieces. The roots of Reform and Conservative Judaism are found in these moments, but so are the roots of the Orthodoxy that we know today. And a segment of them, led by a rabbi named Moshe Sofer, drew the gates, pulled the curtains, and declared, "Kol Chadash Asur, whatever is new is forbidden." And in that moment, froze their world, leaving their dress, their language, their education systems, their social modalities, all the products of the 1800s. The establishment of the State of Israel, by any rational assessment, the most important and transformative event in Jewish history in the past 2,000 years, is shunned by them. And at time, it would only come to matter in terms of what the state would provide to them in terms of subsidies. And as I said last week, with the Begin government and then nearly every Netanyahu government, they have granted stable coalitions in exchange for a suite of benefits. In becoming political kingmakers, they have asked for a king's ransom, except now the people who pay the king his ransom are angry with their empty receipt. And as time is drawn closer to that Supreme Court decision a few weeks ago, the Sephardic chief rabbi announced in a press conference that if they will be forced to go into the army, that they as a community would pick up and leave for America. But if he meant that to be a threat, it fell on his face. First, people were calling up El Al, offering to buy one-way tickets. I'm serious. And two, they were reminded by rabbis in America that if they go there, they'll have to go work. The irony was clear, that only in a democratic Jewish state, that they abhorred, only that state would pay for their ghetto. And among the many questions that this has forced upon us, some dealt with last week, some we will talk about today, a lot of others for another time, is this one. Why now? With Israel facing seven different theaters of military threats, why tackle this now? And the answer is because Israel is facing seven different theaters of military threat. To understand this, you have to look back over the past 25 years of Israeli military doctrine, starting in the late 1990s. Back then, Israel began to advance a theory of a different kind of military to deal with a different kind of threat, that its longtime enemies in Egypt, Syria, and Jordan had either signed peace agreements or were weakened to the point where they were no longer military threats, that large-scale ground invasions and wars seemed to be a thing of the past, and in place of them was to be a smaller, nimble army augmented by leading-edge technology, AI, and drones, and robots, Unit 8200, TAPUs, and cyber warfare. A quick scan of the Israeli companies on the NASDAQ are proof enough of what the graduates from these units did when they were discharged from their service. As a result, entire units in the army were eliminated or combined with others. Tank numbers were drawn down. Combat units were reduced or eliminated. In their place, technology and intelligence units grew exponentially. The new ethos was that computer code and not bullets would save us. It all seemed to be working until it didn't. On October the 8th, that conception collapsed. And Israelis suddenly clearly saw what had been growing for years before their eyes now encroached at their doorstep. The Iranian octopus had its lethal tentacles everywhere. North in Lebanon, south in Gaza, east in Syria, in Yemen and the Sudan. And when the reservists were called up on October the 7th, the army saw a 120% conscription rate. And despite that, over months of a grinding urban war, one thing became very clear to everyone, that the army is too small to cover the north, the east, and the south. Reservists had been online for 3, sometimes 4 months, which is socially, psychologically, and economically devastating. And when these reservists came home, they said, "Die, no more, enough, dying." Not no more to serving, but no more to doing it while others don't. And this is the full meaning behind the protests that you see now. So for this morning, I want to share with you two arguments. The two arguments that the Haredim, that they should offer their participation in the army, and also two that argue that they shouldn't, the arguments that they make. Of course, they are important to understand, because things come to be because of ideas. And this problem, like all societal ones, are the products of ideas that people either embrace or ignore. Okay, so the first. That Israel has been able to survive for 75 years because it has done what its enemies have not done. Most of the countries around Israel have GDPs that are dwarfed by Kentucky. But after each round of war, Israel has thrown itself into building an economy and society that now is amongst the most dynamic in the world, and it will do it again after this war is completed. But the country can no longer accomplish this, the argument goes, by having 20% of its population on the sidelines, that the entry of the Haredim into the army and the economy will catapult it, that they need to acknowledge that their wagon is hitched to the future of the country as all of ours is. Just by way of note of one thing, that the Turing Prize, which is likened to be the Nobel Prize of computer science, was just awarded to another Israeli this week, that Israel is second to only one other country in the world to have won this prize over its 75 years of inception. It is dwarfed only by the United States, that has 40 times its population. The second argument against them remaining on the sidelines is from their playbook, the playbook of halakha, of Jewish law. Biblical law emphatically directs us, al talmud b'dam re'echa, which is understood as the Good Samaritan law, that you cannot, in a life-threatening moment, wait for others to do what needs to be done. This law speaks to everyone directly. When human life is endangered, you are commanded to step forward. No matter that others may come, you must step forward. Now, from the other side, the Charedim argue that without Torah, without people studying Torah, there is no Jewish people. And while there are those who might argue, it must be acknowledged that this is a truth. It is Torah which has shaped and formed the identity of the Jews for thousands of years. Because long before there was a King David and a Solomon, long before the walls of Jerusalem were laid on their foundation, a people formed and were held together by the power of an idea contained in a book. We know this to be true because the records of early Israelites are not hundreds, but thousands of years old, 3,400 to be close. And it comes to us not in the ruins of cities and palaces, but in words. Through the long, at times horrible, night of a 2,000-year exile, the great light which shone on the Jews was their love for Torah. As the Torah made them, they made it too. And out of that tradition came the philosophy of Maimonides, the Ibn Ezra, Rashi, Spinoza, Einstein, and Freud, and so many others. The Haredi devotion to Torah, while not only theirs, is worthy of praise of what it gives to the Jewish state and Jews everywhere. The second argument that they make, spoken at the same event by the Sephardic chief rabbi, where he threatened to leave to go to America, is that the success on the battlefield is only by merit of the study halls of the Haredi community. And to this idea, we cannot be so kind. Because Jewish tradition tells us that human life is defined by human action. Faith, of course, is a part of it, but it must be subservient to action. But perhaps the clearest answer to this final argument of theirs is found in a story that I told last week, but this time with something in the story I didn't share with you. That this story takes place in 1952 between one of the leaders of the Haredi community, a Rabbi Avraham Karolitz, and the Prime Minister then, David Ben-Gurion. It was at this meeting that the question of Haredi integration, of military service and general education were debated subjects, and the rabbi explained to Ben-Gurion that his opposition to their integration in the military and general education was based on this story from the Talmud. Two camels are on a winding mountain road. One is going up, and the other camel is going down. One is carrying a load and the other is not. Because the road is tight, they can't pass by each other. One must stop and move to the side to give space for the other to go. And the Talmud asks, which one stops and which one passes? And the answer they give is the one who is carrying the load has the right to pass first. And so the rabbi leaned into Ben-Gurion, the prime minister, and said that we, the religious, who carried the burden all these thousands of years to get our people back to this land, deserve the consideration, and you should move aside. In most versions of that story, Ben-Gurion is uncharacteristically silent. But a future president of the State of Israel, Yitzhak Navon, who was Ben-Gurion's private secretary at that moment, was there. And in his notes, he wrote that Ben-Gurion, in fact, answered the rabbi. Rabbi, he said, all the study Torah studied by thousands of students in the hundreds of European yeshivot did not succeed in saving one Jew from the Holocaust. Just as Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen were not liberated by love and calls for a ceasefire, but with tanks and machine guns. Which is to say that Jewish tradition is filled with two things, study and prayer. When we study, God talks to us. But study without prayer is insufficient, because when we pray, both with words and with deed, it is we who speak to God. In Jewish tradition, there is no waiting for miracles to come save us, only the hope that humans will heed the call. Because when Moses is standing at the Red Sea, he begins to pray for a miracle to happen, and God tells him to stop praying and to lead the people through the water. It is only then that the waters part. And I know what was true then is true now. Shabbat Shalom.